from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. Don Mayhew spent his professional and public life as an engineer before serving 8 years in the Missouri House. And now the Crocker Republican is hoping to continue his public service by prevailing in a highly competitive GOP primary for the 16th senatorial district. Mayhew joins us on Politically Speaking to talk about his views on key issues and why he would be the best GOP candidate in the race. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democrat country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in oral over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio's politics correspondent, Jason Rosenbaum. I'm once again in the Richmond Heights Bureau of St. Louis Public Radio, and joining us from the Rolla Bureau of St. Louis Public Radio is St. Louis Public Radio's Rolla correspondent,
Jonathan Aull.
And our guest today, he is one of three major Republican candidates running for the 16th senatorial district. Our guest today is
Don Mayhew.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm asking this question to all three candidates. It's almost like a pop quiz. For listeners that don't know, what are the six counties that make up the 16th district?
Okay, so we'll start at the northeast corner and work our way west. We have Marys, Phelps, and Dent, and we have Pulaski, Laclede, and Wright.
You got it right. You are now allowed to run for the seat.
Exactly. So it's if you have a problem with that question, you might be running for the wrong seat.
We have never had you on Politically Speaking before, so I want to give you the opportunity to tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you got involved in Missouri politics.
Voters over here, in at least over in Phelps County, will remember me as being their state representative for about 4 years there in my first two terms in the House of Representatives. I'm born and raised over in Crocker, Missouri, one of 10 children. I'm a father of four and grandfather of 11, and pretty much lived in Crocker most of my life. Like I said, born and raised there. And I have a small business in Waynesville, Missouri, where I have a small engineering and consulting firm where I do engineering and surveying, and have been there since 1996. And been in the various offices in up and down the line. I was elected county surveyor for 10 years, and was on the Crocker School Board for 6, and been in the House of Representatives for 8 years, where I have spent all 8 years on Budget Committee. Most people don't like that committee, and I'm not saying it's not a lot like dragging your fingernails down a chalkboard every day, but I do like it because it is the one thing that we do that is our constitutional duty. In fact, they're our only constitutional duty, but it also has a visible impact every year. I mean, we have to deal obviously with the budget every year, and you can see the good and the bad about what we do in the legislature right there in that committee, and you can have the biggest immediate effect, and that's why I enjoy being on that committee. Other than that, I'm an engineer and a surveyor, so I thought I was going to Jeff City to focus on infrastructure items. Because that was my knowledge base, and I don't know if it's unfortunate or unfortunate, but as it turns out, most of our time is spent dealing with either education or healthcare issues, and in fact, nearly half our budget this year is healthcare related, 40% of which is Medicaid alone. Our education budget obviously increases every year. We're in that $10 billion range. And so that obviously we're spending that much money there on those two items. We do a lot of focus in those areas.
We'll definitely talk about those issues in a few minutes. But why did you decide to run for this open Senate seat?
The biggest reason is that, quite honestly, there's a lot of dysfunction on that side of the building. We're able to accomplish a lot, for better or for worse, on the House side of the building. But I think our rules require us to cooperate a little bit better on the House side. On the Senate side, tradition aside, there are some improvements that could be made there, rule-wise, and we can talk about those later. But it's the complete dysfunction is what encouraged me to run. But I think there's a high level of frustration with members, especially the ones that come out of the House with that dysfunction. Some of it, like I said, is about rules, but a lot of it is about, quite honestly, the way campaigns are funded. I mean, I don't know any nice way to say that, but there's a huge emphasis on campaign contributions, and frequently the level of contributions that are made frequently get in the way of good policy. And so that's the things that I've noticed with 8 years in there, and I think you would get the same general consent from most of the people who are running, but certainly members that are currently serving, the level of campaign contributions certainly now is affecting good policy. So I'm trying to change that trajectory in my way. And I think there are some members over there who share my concern, and I think if we keep electing folks who are focused on their constituents and not on the lobbyists, I think we can make a difference.
I think the last time you and I talked before today, we were about a mile north of here at the Protoplex on Missouri S&T's campus.
Right.
And the governor had a session on AI and data centers. Yep. And it was an incredibly – and it was just very unusual because most time you get a big room full of people talking about data centers and AI, they're very angry about it. But this room was very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
The governor is supportive. The governor's agencies are supportive. Missouri S&T is supportive. You have called for a special session to talk about regulations. So I'm wondering what led you to do that, and maybe how significant of an issue do you see that being for the state of Missouri and in this district that you're running for?
So, you know, data centers became a topic probably a couple of years ago, but without a lot of attention. We really didn't get a lot of attention until Google announced that they were going to do a $14 billion investment here in Missouri. We all love economic development. We all love jobs that are created, even if a significant number of them with the Google project are construction related. However, that industry has drawn themselves some bad press over the years and have caused some concern to folks about how they had operated in other states. And certainly, from what Google was, or, you know, the proponents were saying right here at S&T about some of those things that they've addressed, is probably not getting enough playtime. But there are three issues that come up consistently that that folks, I think, have legitimate concerns about. Now, we in the legislature move at the pace of the slowest snail in the bunch, right? And these data centers move at the speed of light. And, you know, no pun intended, the reality is that most of them that are going to be built here in Missouri are going to be either under contract or under construction within the next year or so. But the problems that as best as I can tell, are not being directly addressed, that are legitimate concerns. Let's start with the first one, the water. Now, there's a lot of noise out there on the internet, and most of it is just wrong. about the water. However, there is an issue related to water that I believe is a legitimate concern that we could address immediately and probably should address immediately, and that is based in the cooling water. Okay, well, where if I was advising them as an engineer, where would I advise them to drill their well, and how deep would that well be? Well, I would tell them to drill the well in the shallow aquifer. If they're not using it for potable water, it's just cooling water, then it becomes just like irrigation water down in southeast Missouri. There's no need to worry about the quality of the water. Well, unfortunately, that 400-foot range is also where local domestic wells are tapping. That's their aquifer that they're tapping. And so there's a legitimate concern of neighbors who are immediately adjacent to Google about how much water they're drawing out of that aquifer. We call it the cone of influence. So the more water you draw out, the more that spreads out and could cross over into domestic wells nearby. I think that's an easy solution to the problem. We might be able to do it with regulation. I'd be a little bit more comfortable with codifying it to put them in the same category we put industrial users that are using processed water. And so why is that a difference? Well, because right now they can drill a well that is simply used for irrigation or for cooling water, and they don't fit under those industrial regulations. So if they fit under the industrial regulations, they have a different reporting requirement to DNR. Okay, so now that puts them under someone who's monitoring the water use and et cetera. So my preference would be is that on the water issue, we can solve a lot of those concerns with their neighbors by just moving them into a different classification. We don't have to do statewide planning and zoning in order to do that. We simply require that, you know, users of a certain size have to meet these industrial standards. Okay, once again, perfect thing for a special session. Now, the next thing is the electricity. Well, you know, the proponents of SB4 were promoting SB4 as a way to attract these kind of businesses. I would agree with them. The problem with it is that what we're going to see in the immediate future prior to CWIP even taking place, if it ever does, is that the demand on electricity follows the exact same supply and demand curve as anything else that you buy or sell. And this instantaneous demand on the system is going to naturally drive up the price. Well, that's also going to encourage more talk about creating more power generation, which means more emphasis on collecting additional funds for CWIP. Okay, Google, best as my knowledge, signed a 15-year contract with Ameren. Well, probably a couple things you should be asking yourself is, why a 15-year contract? Why not 10? Why not 20? Well, I don't know. I wasn't involved in those negotiations, but I believe that it is because we know, you know, if you listen to Elon Musk and other prognosticators that have been correct pretty much, they're telling us that these things are going to be dinosaurs in 10 to 15 years. You know, we're probably around the corner from quantum computing and other technologies that are going to be able to store a lot of data in a very small space, and that these data centers are just going to go away. Okay, so having said that, if it's going to take 20 years to bring the power plants online that will be created simply to supply electricity to data centers, and then we don't need the data centers anymore, but the folks have been paying CWIP these additional fees all along, well, then how does that figure into the mix? And so are we truthfully, as a residential ratepayer, simply subsidizing Google's operation? Well, I would submit to you that we are, and I would submit to you that SB4 it actually encourages that. And so when the circus leaves town, right, who gets left holding this thing? Well, the ratepayers are going to be on the hook for the increased demand. The county is going to be on the hook for this empty 40-acre building, which is the third thing, is that, you know, who takes care of it when we don't need it anymore? a good friend of mine said, yeah, he said, you know, in 10 to 15 years, that's going to be the world's biggest pickleball court. I'm not sure they need that in Montgomery County, but it will be there. And so, you know, those are things that I think we can address. That decommissioning thing is a real thing. And I don't know that the local commissioners have taken that into account. I mean, I can take you to several small, medium-sized towns in the state that have two empty Walmart buildings, right? Empty supercenters, because they can't, there's no business that wants to move into them. And so I'm afraid that we will get in that situation, for instance, in a place as rural as Montgomery County. So, but honestly, I get all that. Most people, their concerns are about being a neighbor to them, right? Because I don't care if I'm certain they've addressed the noise issue. But the one thing that they haven't addressed and one thing they cannot avoid is these things look like an airport if you're living next door to them. I mean, they are lit up. And so I would say that that's going to affect property values and that Google and Amazon should address the effect on property values in the immediate vicinity with their neighbors. And so I think we can do that in a reasonable way that doesn't discourage development, but also gives the proper protections to the adjacent neighbors to these operations.
Okay, so that's a lot of great detail.
Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. the only AI or data center bill that had any movement in the legislation, one bill got a hearing in the House and died there. Mm-hmm. Nothing happened in the Senate. You and a few other people have called for a special session. Kehoe has made it pretty clear by his silence he's not interested in that at all. If you get elected and you are in the Senate, will you introduce legislation? And do you think it will actually go anywhere, considering our track record over the last 12 months?
I think the public's outcry on this, because, I mean, I hear this at almost every door. I don't know about the other districts. Mm-hmm. I do know in the 16th district that this is a concern. They're going to expect us to do something. And now it's a lot of it's going to be the cow's already out of the barn kind of a thing, right? Because Google will be well under construction, and because of ex post facto, we can't pass a law to make them subject to something that, you know, that they're already in the process of doing. We can only affect those that are being built in the future. That was the other need for the special session, was so that we could address those concerns right now, so that the people could be relieved that at least the legislature and the governor were concerned about their concerns. The other thing, too, is and I tried to explain this to folks who had talked to me about it, was this: I don't see how this is a bad thing even for Google, right? Right now, there's a lot of rumor and speculation running around the internet, Facebook, and everywhere else. Now, I know, I mean, I'm not a big fan of data centers for sure, but the reality is that I know, as an engineer, I recognize a lot of that is just being noise. Well, the way to clear that noise out is to have public hearings where folks can come in and express their opinions one way or the other. We can get the experts to sit in front of us and talk to us about it, and then people can make a decision based on an informed position. And that was the other thing that I think was ignored because they were afraid that it may generate bad press. Well, I mean, you get the bad press no matter what, right? So the truth is that a special session would have even helped on that side of it. So I appreciate the governor's position on it. And perhaps if I was sitting in his shoes, I would probably make the same decision. I don't know. But I think that this further outcry, and the longer this goes without us addressing it, the worse it gets for other – we've got cities right now. I think Rolla itself is talking about doing a moratorium on data centers, and I don't even think there was one even on the horizon for it.
I want to talk about video lottery terminals. What was your posture when that legislation came through the House to legalize and regulate them?
Okay, so there we've probably seen in the House at least five different versions of that bill. So the ones that I had originally supported took various forms, most of which was a situation that that paid that. So the number one complaint for folks who represent the lottery, who sell lottery tickets, is that it's not enough money to mess with. You know, they get about 5.7 cents per dollar played, basically, and they have staff that has to manage those tickets, et cetera. And so that was their complaint all along. So the original one of the original bills was a third, and a third. The state got a third of the money to do with whatever they wanted. The owner of the machines got a third, and then the person who had the machines in their store got a third. Well, it seemed like a fair division. But the key provision of all of those was is that the illegal machines, which no one can deny now, right? There's no legal maneuvering that gets you out of the fact that those machines that have been in place, generally a bunch of them for about 10 years, were illegal gaming devices, period, full stop, right? So every bill before ended their existence on day one, right? They were removed and perhaps replaced at some point with the quote-unquote legal devices. Okay. Well, some of us who were a little reluctant to go along with it anyway said, okay, that's a reasonable compromise. If we are going to go down this road of regulation for these things, then at the very least we shouldn't be rewarding illegal behavior. Unfortunately, this current bill, and it took a similar form last year, but the only reason I was able to vote for it last year was because there was an amendment put on there that required those illegal machines to be removed on day one. Okay, so fast forward to the one last year, no such thing. In fact, the original bill would have allowed those machines to stay in place indefinitely, running along side by side with the legal machines. Well, if you don't have to pay any taxes on one device and you do on the other one, and so it maximizes your profit for the other one, why would you ever put the quote-unquote legal machines in? Okay, so recognizing that was a non-starter, well, then that was limited to 1 year. Okay, but when you read the language of it, it was limited to 1 year unless there was a lawsuit involving the machines. So what it did was encourage the owner of the quote-unquote illegal machines to file a lawsuit in order to leave their machines in place. So and we know how that works. Sometimes those things can take 10 years. And so that, to me, was a 100% non-starter. I was barely okay with the whole idea of them in the first place because I believe that not just the lottery, but certainly those machines, but is all a tax on poor people, plain and simple. You know, at the very least, casinos can find it to one location. But the truth is the lottery and certainly the VLTs, I have yet to see a rich person play in those machines. And if you talk about people with disposable income, that 18 to 34-year-old male category, they don't play these machines either. You know, those are your online gamers. You know, they're doing the sports betting and all that stuff. So truthfully, all we are seeing with this legalization of these things is cannibalizing money from the lottery, which, by the way, supports education by about 25 cents on the dollar, and moving it over to the VLT machines, which are only going to support elementary and secondary education to 2.5 cents on the dollar, 20% of which has to go to capital improvements only. So this makes no sense from any side of the equation. If you think that we can fund education through gaming, well, you wouldn't want these things, because they're costing us a tenfold decrease in available education dollars that have to be made up with either general revenue or an increase in some tax somewhere, and probably the sales tax. So there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to support this version of it. And if I was a convenience store owner and somebody actually showed me how this worked, I would definitely not be for it. But if you are a proponent that we can fund education through these mechanisms, well, then you still wouldn't be for it. And so I hate to call that a nutshell because that was about 4 minutes worth of stuff.
Well, it was, but I want to ask this because I say this as somebody who just finds most gambling abhorrent except fantasy football. So I have a weird value system. But I kind of see this fight as between two proxies, the VLT machines and the casinos,
yeah.
both of which do bad things
yeah.
to further gambling addiction.
Right.
What would you say to people who say that if you vote against legalizing and regulating VLTs, you're essentially just doing the bidding of casino companies that don't want gas stations to be competition for them?
Well, so that's certainly true. I mean, that is at least the argument. But that is also the way lobbyists divide folks into camps that they can manage, right? They're, you know, if you are a more libertarian, then you're going to be against tax credits no matter what, period, exclamation point. But then when you go to that individual and you talk to that exact same individual who says, I'm a no tax credit ever for any reason, and you ask him about, well, what about the pregnancy resource tax credit? Well, now suddenly that's different, right? Well, but that is that's one of the strategies that's used up in the Capitol. And so being someone like me who doesn't fit well in either camp and have voted against, some occasionally for, one thing or the other, I'm not a reliable check mark. And so that presents a problem for the lobbyists. They want everybody to fit in nice little categories. And so they can say that. They can say, okay, well, this is a casino guy and this is a VLT guy. Well, we had the same kind of sort of thing with the sports betting versus the VLT. And then the casinos were kind of tangentially related to that, only because they didn't like the VLTs. They don't like the sports betting either, but they could put up with the sports betting because they had an opportunity to make a little money off of it. But that is how Jeff City kind of works. It was what you had kind of alluded to, is that we want our little pockets, you know, our groups, and we want to be able to put people in these categories and with no crossover. You know, if you're a crossover person, then you're a flip-flopper. Well, you're not a flip-flopper, you know, but it's just that the lobbyists want this clean and neat, and that whole subject is not clean and neat. It appears that at some point in the past, I've never voted for it, was that we thought that gaming would solve our financial woes. Well, the only financial woes that were solved were the people who run gaming. Those were the folks who came out ahead, and it would be no different with the VLTs. This is certainly not going to solve our education funding deficit because of everything I'd said earlier, but it won't even approach it. I mean, the lottery itself provides about, I think this year would be about 5% of total revenue to education. Well, I remember when it was promoted, the same with casino gambling. Oh, there's all this money going to education and all this money going to veterans. And so here we sit with 4%, 5% after all the trouble we went through. But we have noticed, as with sports betting, that the folks running sports betting are making money hand over fist. However, the state of Missouri ain't getting much.
We'll be right back with more of State Representative Don Mayhew on Politically Speaking. And we're back on Politically Speaking with Don Mayhew. He is one of three major Republican candidates running for Missouri's 16th senatorial district seat. Jonathan, I'm going to throw it back to you for more questions.
I want to talk about education.
Okay.
And my canary in the coal mine has been both my kids graduated from Rolla High School.
Yep.
And one of their very favorite teachers left this year because she's just not making enough money.
Yeah.
And now she's working at home for a company that she can work remote for and just make a heck of a lot more money.
Oh, 100%.
And they're not going to be able to replace her. They're just not.
Absolutely.
And so how do we make sure that we are providing the best education for our kids when we can't when Missouri ends up at the bottom of lists of what we pay teachers, and we've got good teachers who say, I just can't afford to have this job anymore, I have to go do something else, something I don't even like as much, but mm-hmm. something that will just let me provide for my family? How do we solve that?
So So, and there's a couple of different things in there, but let's start with the first one. And this is probably rule specific, and you probably can't apply this everywhere. So I am very familiar with a lot of teachers. In fact, my daughter-in-law is a teacher, and my sister was a teacher. In almost every case of a teacher leaving prior to being fully vested in the retirement system, that's less than 5 years, they did not leave because of the pay. They told me it was administrator support, right? Yes, the pay wasn't great, but it wasn't it's so horrible that they, you know, had a had an issue. A big issue with it. But it's administrator support. Well, I don't know how exactly we address that problem in any effective way. I mean, that's a school board problem, right? That's your local school board has to address those issues. And I can appreciate that they can be reluctant with contract staff to, you know, put the onerous onto the people who are responsible for that. Okay. On the pay issue, we passed minimum teacher salary. We did well, the only way that we could do it was by putting it outside the foundation formula. So in order for us to put the minimum teacher salary to make sure that it gets funded, so it's not subject to, you know, whatever the legislature wants to do, is to get it inside the foundation formula. Okay, every single administrator or anyone else who knows anything about the foundation formula complains about the foundation formula and talks about how much it needs to be fixed. We all agree that it needs to be fixed. And then every single opportunity, including the governor's task force on this, always reverts back to the same divisions, right? I don't care about fixing the foundation formula as long as you're not going to fix my part. Right. And so that's what we're kind of seeing. I'm hoping that the cooler heads will prevail and we will end up with something. But just one example to show you, the dollar value modifier was put in there to favor urban schools, but not for any good reason. It's because there's more legislators from urban areas. Well, that's detrimental to rural schools, period, exclamation point. And everybody agrees with that. But when you talk to the urban schools about getting rid of the dollar value modifier, guess what they say? Oh, no, don't touch my little pie, right? So a former state representative, and I'm going to give him a shout out because he did the yeoman's work on that thing. He spent his entire 8 years trying to figure this problem out. And he talked to everyone involved, and he finally got it massaged to the point where 95% of the schools their funding would stay the same. It got rid of all the stuff, the hold harmless schools and all that other stuff everybody complains about. Got it where 95% of the schools would see no funding change. 2.5% would go up and 2.5% would go down. And you know what? All of his partners said in that represent education organizations, they said, we are not going along with anything that doesn't either keep it the same or raise for everyone. Even though that 2.5% of those schools have significant local effort that goes into funding them. And so if you're going to be that intransigent on the one complaint that you have in education, not sure the legislature can fix that. However, I am willing to try and make sure that we have a consistent source. One thing I can say is that I'm actually pretty proud of is that we have successfully managed to keep a 40% floor on transportation reimbursement in the budget every year because of the passage of 335 first and then Senate Bill 727.
Who was that state lawmaker that you wanted to give a shout-out to?
That was David Wood. David Wood. Yeah, sorry about that. I meant to give him a shout-out, but that was David Wood. Yep, absolutely.
So let's talk about the ballot initiatives that are going to be up for a vote in August. And I do want to ask one about that's going to be on in November. You voted to put Amendment 4 on the ballot, which would make it harder for some constitutional amendments to pass. For context, to people who don't know about Amendment 4, any constitutional amendment that's put on the ballot through initiative petition process would need 8 out of 8 congressional districts and a simple majority to pass. Constitutional amendments that are put on by the legislature would need just a simple majority. So you voted to put it on the ballot. Do you support this proposal? And explain why you do or you don't support it.
Okay, so the U.S. Constitution fits comfortably in the breast pocket of this jacket. We don't change it very often. The Missouri Constitution, you know, one year we added about 70 pages to the Missouri Constitution. In fact, the marijuana amendment added 43 pages of lawyer gobbledygook that basically was just creating a monopoly for four big gummy companies. The edibles apparently is where all the money is in marijuana. But essentially that's what it done. It was just a spec sheet to make it where those companies would have a monopoly. What we're seeing is, and I think this can be acknowledged on both supporters and opponents of any measure that comes along, is that it is way too easy to change our Missouri Constitution. And it would be different if these were actually initiative petitions by people, but they're not. They are promoted by, written by, mostly outside companies who are wanting to change our Constitution, not in favor of the people, but in favor of their own business. Well, if you can get away with it, okay, I guess that's one thing. So requiring that a majority of the folks in all eight congressional districts then moves the requirement that these companies must, that are doing all this, have to also advertise and promote their idea to rural populations. Right now, Kansas City and St. Louis, generally, that's not exactly true, but generally true, can pass just about anything they want. And no better example than would be the marijuana amendment and Medicaid expansion. And so those things are not things that rural Missouri would necessarily promote or accept. However, in both cases, they knew they didn't need rural Missouri in order to pass it. So at the very least, what it's going to do is it's going to require that an amendment proposed by someone, it has to have broad appeal. I would submit to you that any citizen petition that might come up would be only done if there was broad appeal for it anyway. An example, maybe perhaps sunsetting every tax in the Constitution. I guarantee you that would have broad appeal, correct?
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah. I do have to push back against you for a little bit, and I think you even acknowledged I was going to push back.
Oh, yeah.
If St. Louis County, Jackson County, and Boone County voted for something, it wouldn't pass. If that was the case, then we would have all Democratic statewide officials. Well, the reason why a lot of these initiatives have passed is because they found support in Republican-dominated, highly populated counties like St. Charles and Jefferson County. The marijuana initiative passed in St. Francis County, which is not exactly an urban county. And I also think, like, yeah, you look at a map of some of these initiatives that failed in some of these rural counties, but they got like 30, 40, 45% of the vote, which is higher than what you would usually vote for a Democratic candidate. So is that argument that rural voters are being ignored here, does that kind of leave out a lot of important context, like what I just mentioned?
Okay, so the context that you're probably missing there is that the assumption would be a significant part of the electorate would participate, but we're not seeing that. So if you go back and look at marijuana, basically 22% of the electorate hung that millstone around our neck. Now, I don't care if you're for or against marijuana. There were three pro-marijuana organizations who came out against that amendment for all of the reasons that I said. However, they were able to spend about $42 million convincing people that all this was about was grandpa smoking marijuana for his chemotherapy. When we all knew who read the 43 pages, we knew that really didn't have anything to do with it. So the point of all that is, and I think your point is well taken, and I acknowledge that if you're not going to participate, this is the kind of stuff that happens to you. So if we want to take marijuana, for instance, Boone County, Jackson County, St. Louis County, and I'm pretty sure Greene County all had about a 70% voter turnout. My own county, Pulaski County, had a 38% voter turnout. And if you go and you go look at the voter turnout in the various rural counties, there was about eight others that were below 40% voter turnout. Okay, so having said that, whose responsibility then is it to come back against these things? You are correct that if those rural counties were to show up in the same numbers, there's limitations there, of course. Urban areas is a little easier to get to the polls. I admit that. But in reality, if we had universal voter turnout at whatever number, whether it's 70%, you're probably correct that rural areas would start to influence it more. So whose fault is it? Well, I think it's partially because of one fact that goes unnoticed, is that 90% of all political advertising, no matter what it is for, is about not about you, me convincing you to vote for my thing. It's about convincing you that your candidate doesn't stand a chance, and so therefore, why bother showing up to vote? And the same is true with petitions. You need no more proof of that than the polling associated with any political office. Certainly, here in the 16th district, you can see a poll that favors just about everyone if you want to go look for that.
Yeah, I would say polling for a state senate race is probably not the best thing to do. But just before I move on to five, just want to make clear, you are in support of four, and you'll be voting yes on it.
Definitely in favor of. So, can I say one last thing on four? Now, Yes. Now the distinction has been drawn about people saying, well, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. It should happen also for the petitions, the initiatives that are put out by the legislature. Well, let's think about that one. I file an HJR, and it goes to a committee. It has to pass out of that committee by a majority of the support. But we also get the opportunity to amend it. And then it goes to two other committees before it ever gets to the floor. Everywhere along the line, we're able to put amendments on it. Then it goes over to the Senate and it goes through the exact same process. So we've got about six or eight opportunities to amend something. And so I asked people who are concerned about that, I said, how many times did you get the opportunity to amend the marijuana amendment? And of course, they're at zero. It's either you take it or you don't. So that distinction is helpful because the public also has the opportunity to voice their opinion about whatever it is that we are doing up there, including on the HJRs. At every single one of those committee hearings, it is a public hearing where the public can comment. So that would be the distinction between the two. And yes, obviously, I'm from a rural area, so I'm in favor of it. So
on five, I saw a Facebook video saying that you voted to put five, which for listeners that don't know what five is, it would allow the legislature to expand or increase sales or use taxes as a way to eliminate the income tax. I saw that you voted to put it on the ballot, but you called it a pig in a poke.
Yep.
And you think it's a bad idea, which, no, look, I know some people are going to criticize you for putting it on the ballot and saying you're against it, but that happens a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to give you that.
Okay.
But I have been frank. I'm just going to be blunt here. Bill Hardwick said he went to every city and county in the 16th district and is getting immense hostility about five. That is absolutely shocking to me that Republican areas like the 16th district are so hostile to this idea. I don't think this is going to get 40% of the vote if that's true. Is that your feeling too?
So I don't think it's getting 40% of the vote in the 16th district. I don't know how it's playing otherwise. So here it is essentially.
Hold on, before you answer, you think it's going to get below 40% in the 16th district?
I'm saying it has challenges in the 16th district. I'd say majority of the doors that I knock, where people want to talk to me, that is, I'm going to say that's with along with data centers, that is the things that they want to talk about. Okay, so first of all, I have to say I'm a big fan of the fair tax. So I'm going to use Tennessee as the example, and I'm not going to say Tennessee's perfect. But I took a version of Tennessee, kind of tailored it for Missouri, and was in the process of trying to work through some of the difficulties with it because business, you know, the chamber and all of those folks, they need to weigh in on this kind of stuff, you know, kind of in that drafting process so that you've got less issues, okay? So then taking that to leadership and saying, okay, at that point, nothing had been filed on it at all, the HDR or nothing. So the sentiment was, in leadership, was, well, we don't want anything to confuse the subject, right? And besides, your bill can't take effect until till the HJR is done. Okay, so, and I said this is not a state secret by any stretch of the imagination, that yeah, I really don't want to leave that in the hands of the legislature, that if we truly are going to go down this path, then the people need to weigh in on it at some point. Now, let's assume for a moment that it does pass. Let's say this big advertising campaign somehow sways the majority of the voters in the 16th district into, you know, voting for it. Okay, fine. My issue then is the one that's been expressed by just about everybody. They don't trust the legislature, and I think for good reason, for not handing out exceptions to the highest bidder. That's my problem with it. Had we done my bill that I didn't file because, you know, once again, leadership was like, yeah, we ain't doing your thing. The reality is that I, me personally, don't like voting for something that I don't know what the end result is. So if, as we all know, that it can easily be done that he who has the highest paid lobbyist gets an exception. Governor's already promised three exceptions. Real estate, I'm good with that. Ag already has no sales tax on practically everything. The only thing they're paying is an income tax. Well, I'm okay with that. On medicine, however, there's a few distinctions that need to be made in there, which I'm okay with giving an exception to the doctor that's putting grandma's knee replacement in, because that's Medicaid and Medicare dollars anyway. It's just tax and a tax. But I'm not so sure on cosmetic surgery that they need to. But I can envision a path for someone who, as a lobbyist, goes to the Senate and says, hey, you know, this is a doctor, right? These doctors do important work too, so they need an exception. So I don't want to – I'm an engineer and a surveyor. My business would be subject to this tax. I'm okay with it, but I want everybody else to pay it too. I don't want the barbers and the surveyors and the engineers to be the ones left holding the bag. I want the lawyers and the CPAs to also have to pay this tax if I do. So that's where I'm at on it. I don't think that was ever a secret for me. But
yeah, so you're a no. You're voting no on 5.
So I'm voting no on 5.
Well, Representative, thank you so much for joining us today and for all of our coverage of the 2026 primary. Make sure to go to stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a product of the University of Missouri system. And Representative, how could people find out more about your campaign on the World Wide Web?
They can find a lot more information about me on my website, and that is mayhew4missouri.com. That's 4 spelled out, F-O-R, not the number 4. So that's mayhew4missouri.com. Obviously, you can find me on Facebook. I've contributed quite a bit to that. And you just Google my name, and it'll come up.
Thank you very much. Until next time, so long.
Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.